Good morning, everyone. This is the Healthy Idea Podcast by Iman and Nico. I'm Iman.
And I'm Nico. And on our podcast, we sit down with founders on how they're using new technologies to solve critical health issues that face our society today. We learn more about their journeys into entrepreneurship and how they started their company.
We hope to shed light on innovations in health and encourage you to think on the art of what's possible with technology today.
Welcome back, everyone, to the A Healthy Idea Podcast. Today, we have the co-founder and CEO of Wealth, Matt Lauper. Welcome to the show, Matt. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, we just moved into our new office here in LA and hoping to open back up after being fully remote for the past couple months here with the pandemic. So it's a fun time for us to get back in the office and start seeing each other again.
Most definitely. My fingers are crossed for you guys. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and your company?
Absolutely. So our company really focuses on helping patients form healthy habits related to their care. So we really focus on those patient populations that have serious chronic conditions and know what they're supposed to do. The doctor tells them, you know, hey, take these medications, check these metrics, you know, maybe even change the way you eat based on their various disease states, but still have trouble following through and building those habits. And what we really focus on is the science of behavioral economics and habit formation and why these patients tend to have these problems, right? And we can talk a lot more about the science there and everything that goes on and how we try to help motivate these patients to adopt these new behaviors. But in general, that's what we really do. We really focus on underserved populations. So working with a lot of Medicaid eligible populations on behalf of either their insurance company or their healthcare system provider. We're starting to do more and more outside of Medicaid. We're doing a lot of Medicare Advantage populations. We're doing full risk Medicare populations on behalf of ACOs. And we're even starting to do a little bit of commercially insured populations and life insurance populations. But, you know, our core focus is the Medicaid and dual eligible populations.
Gotcha. Just quick question. What are ACOs?
ACOs are accountable care organizations. So basically, they're health systems that have financial risk for patient outcomes. So this was a big kind of shift over the past 5 or 10 years in the industry, really related to the passing of the Affordable Care Act. But this shift from a concept of healthcare is a volume-based fee-for-service model today to this value-based, outcomes-based health system where the quality of care is actually what is most important. So a lot of these accountable care organizations were formed to take on that risk on patient outcomes.
Gotcha. So is this thing like skilled nursing or is it just like a subset of things or are they specifically designated as an ACO?
So typically it's integrated delivery network or a big health system or kind of hospital system that has primary care and other components of care who is coordinating the care across those different, that continuum. And most of those were big hospital systems. Now more and more, I think the trend is moving more towards smaller doctor groups taking on risk. So here in California, we have a lot of groups that have been very successful over the course of 20 or so years that are primary care physician groups that instead of going to the hospital and having the risk of the hospital, it's sitting with the kind of local community practices. So examples of that model is more like Healthcare Partners here in California, the Heritage Network here in California, a lot of these new venture-backed entities like Oak Street or Landmark or City Block in New York. These are all care models where it's much more local. You know, in the case of a Landmark, it's even home care, right? There's no doctor's office, but Oak Street is a model where, you know, there's a doctor's office with a lot of community care around it. Same with City Block. City Block is a very interesting model. They serve the similar underserved population in New York City, where it's all about the community and building not even nurses or doctors, but community resources to help these patients.
Gotcha. So how large of an issue would you say medication noncompliance is in the US?
Yeah, so there's some really good stats that often get cited for that. And medication adherence is one of the main behaviors that we focus on improving for our patient populations. It is not the only one. We are in the business of all care habits and, you know, kind of depending on the disease state, there's a number of other habits that you must complete on a daily basis in addition to taking your medications. But just that medication piece itself, previous studies have put a $300 billion a year annual number on the cost of non-adherence. So in other words, the direct cost that is preventable that gets created to the healthcare system because people aren't complying to their medications. So that's the dollar number. About 50%, 50% of patients with these chronic conditions are not compliant to their medications, which is defined as at least 80% of the time they should be taking those medications, they do, right? So about half of the population across these various disease states is less than 80% adherent to their medications on a daily basis.
Wow, that's insane. So just to reiterate for those at home, that's $300 billion with a B just on medication noncompliance alone. And that's solely people who they're properly diagnosed and they're prescribed appropriate treatment, but yet they're just not adhering to the medication plan. And those other things are issues within itself. That's a huge market. And I had no idea that's how large of an issue it was. And so you talked about that it's, you know, it's high risk chronic conditions. So what type of chronic conditions does your company look at and try to change behavior for?
Absolutely. So we focus on type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, congestive heart failure, asthma and COPD, behavioral health conditions, and we've served, you know, everything from depression, anxiety to schizophrenia, psychosis, serious mental illness. We've done a few other population type approaches. We've served a small HIV positive population. We've served gestational diabetes population, done some substance use disorders, especially related to the medication assisted therapy. So, you know, patients that are supposed to be taking medications every day to kind of control their cravings for opiates. So we've done a number of things, but I'd say the core are, you know, kind of the cardiovascular, the metabolic, the congestive heart failure, the asthma, COPD, and behavioral health. Many of our populations, since we focus on this very complex portion of the population, have multiple chronic conditions. So pick any two or three of those. And that is a very, you know, that adherence problem becomes even more of a problem in those patients, right? When we think about this adherence problem and why it exists, we put numbers around how big it is, but why does it exist, right? And how do you solve it? That's the biggest question. There have been a number of companies specifically started in the past 10 years with the focus of improving medication adherence because everyone knows it's a big problem. But I think a lot of those companies don't understand the root of the problem. Right? Because if you ask a patient, why are you not taking these pills? They'll say, well, I know I'm supposed to. I actually want to and intend to take them, but I just don't do it. I don't get around to it. So we as humans, we lock the terminology to describe what's really going on. So often you'll hear these patients say, oh, I forgot, right? So forgetfulness is a common response. So because of that, there's been a number of companies started to solve the forgetfulness problem or perceived forgetfulness problem, right? So give more reminders, or even these connected devices to try to light up or remind you to take the pill or measure that you're taking the pill or putting chips in inhalers, measure if you're taking an inhaler, chips in the pills themselves to measure if you're ingesting the pills, you know, educational programs to coach you on these behaviors. But what I think we've missed the mark as an industry on is the behavioral economics or the psychology side of why are patients not taking the pills. And if you think about, let's stick with one simple example, a diabetic who's prescribed metformin. Most of those diabetics will tell you, I want to and intend to take that pill. The problem is that they take that metformin, they feel no different right now, right? Versus the Snickers bar sitting on the table that they actually know has too much sugar and they shouldn't eat, tastes really good right now. So this is one of these behavioral economic principles called present bias, which means, hey, as humans, our brains aren't meant to think about the long-term intangible benefits of doing a task every day. We can only think about what gives us immediate gratification. So even though the patient knows he or she should be taking that medication and it's good for them, they are not getting immediate gratification from doing the right thing.
Right. That's a problem we see across the board with not even health, but we see it with businesses making plans, short-term thinking versus long-term thinking. We see it in politics. It's just so hard to plan mentally. It's like, I don't want, you know, two apples a week from now. I want an apple today. And so we did some background research and we saw that the problem that you're trying to solve at Wealth kind of hits close to home. And if you're comfortable, would you mind sharing that story with our audience?
Absolutely. So my background was I was a healthcare investor. I worked at one of the largest healthcare investment firms on Wall Street. You know, I was a kid in my early to mid 20s, and that was a really cool job because my job as a, let's say, 25, 26 year old was to grill the CEO of, you know, big companies like Medtronic on their strategic plan and if they're going to hit numbers. And, you know, part of me is like, who am I? Like this person has been in the industry longer than I've been alive. So it was a very cool and exciting job to have. But I kind of felt this need to do something, to build something, and hopefully build something that can help improve either society at large or specifically, since my domain expertise is healthcare, you know, the healthcare system or patients directly. And when I looked at kind of the problems I wanted to work on, I drew inspiration from my own personal experience, as we all do. And when I look at my family, my mom's side has a very serious history of type 2 diabetes. My grandfather on my mother's side and all four of his brothers had type 2 diabetes their whole adult life. Fast forward a generation to my mom's generation. My mom has a brother and a sister. They both have type 2 diabetes. My aunt is your model diabetic, so to speak, right? We'll go to dinner. We get home from dinner. She'll check her blood sugars right away, right? She has every pill laid out by day in a tackle box, and she will never miss a dose. I don't think she's missed a dose in 25 years, right? And she's had no complications over those 25 years because she keeps that disease state so well managed that she's perfectly healthy to this day. Her brother, my Uncle Roy, no matter what we tried, we couldn't get him just to do the things that he knew he should. We would say, hey, did you go to your doctor's appointment? And he'd say, no, I haven't had time to do that yet. We'd say, oh, you know, like, are you taking your medications? Oh, yeah, kind of, but I guess I ran out of one of them and I haven't gone to pick up the refill yet, right? So there's always this gap between his intent and his actual behaviors. And nothing we tried as a family was able to help him overcome that gap. And he ended up with very different outcomes than my aunt, right? He was on dialysis starting in the late 90s or so. He got a kidney transplant in 2003, which in itself was a bit of a miracle. He lived in Hawaii, so there's not many kidneys going around in Hawaii, but luckily he found a match. That really helped him for about 10 or 12 years, and then started to get really sick again around the time I was starting the company. And then about a year or two later, he had a stroke and passed away. So here are two individuals with the same exact disease state, the same exact genetics, the same exact upbringing, but massively different outcomes in terms of their quality of life and length of life, just based on the behaviors that they did on a daily basis. So when I was thinking about what did I actually want to do with my life, I was thinking about, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could help patients like Uncle Roy just do the things that they already know and want to do? I was not a behavioral economist by training. I was a biological engineer, but I really liked this concept of behavior change, especially through technology in a scalable way. And the more I looked into the industry, the research base, and the market potential, the more excited I got about the idea. And I was at a point in my life where, you know, I said, hey, I don't have dependents. I don't have a mortgage. I can take this huge risk and go 3 years with no salary and live off my savings. And I did it. And it was very scary, but it was, and it's been way harder than I ever expected, but it's been by far the most rewarding thing I've ever done. And I wouldn't change anything about that decision.
That's fantastic. I'm so happy to hear that. I am really sorry to hear about your uncle. So I really do appreciate you sharing that story with us.
It's interesting because everything kind of comes full circle. So, you know, my uncle was on dialysis for probably 5 years or so. And, you know, I remember we would always have to figure out a way to get him to the local DaVita clinic, right? Because he at that time was getting harder and harder of eyesight. So, you know, my mom would, we actually would pay a neighbor to take him, right? And so it's funny because then fast forward this year, DaVita was actually one of our biggest investors that came into our round. And now we're working with DaVita on a number of programs, one of which is trying to motivate people to actually show up for their dialysis appointments, not make them. So it's interesting how life always comes back and you kind of think about, oh, like, what if we could have done this, you know, 10 years ago, like, could it have had an impact? But it's always cool to see, you know, time is a flat circle.
Yeah. And just to chime in really quickly, because you mentioned people going to the actual kidney care facilities, it's really hard to go. I remember I have a good family friend, went to a DaVita clinic, and it's really hard to go sometimes. It's not, it's a motivational driver. So that's amazing that you guys are working with DaVita to fix that issue. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, dialysis is not a fun process. You talked about behavioral economics. You've kind of hinted to it, but what about it makes it so powerful? Like, what makes it different from everything else that people have tried?
Yeah, I think it's just a more complete and accurate view of or model of human behavior. You know, to summarize, the classical economic model assumed if you give people the right information, they will make the choice in their own best interest. So if you remember back, you know, kind of the foundation of classical economics was Adam Smith, right? We might have read about that in history class, right? And the whole concept was the invisible hand, right? So basically, there was this invisible hand that was guiding markets to the most efficient choice. And therefore, that's on a macro perspective. On a micro perspective, it's because the individuals are making that most efficient choice, right? Well, that's not necessarily true, right? Humans aren't perfect. We're not Mr. and Miss Fox, you know, who are perfectly rational and making the choice that's always rationally in our best interest. And we have a number of cognitive biases that prevent the right choice from being made. So I think, you know, why is it powerful? Well, it actually takes human psychology into account and tries to study why people actually make the decisions they make. Why it's so scalable is because we all fall victim to these cognitive biases, no matter who we are, all have them. We all have biased decision-making. We all take shortcuts in thinking, and we don't always use our, you know, cognitive facilities to make the right choice. So the reason why it can be so impactful is because the same principles are displayed by almost every human. And so, you know, a common catchphrase kind of coined by Dan Ariely at Duke was, humans are irrational, but we're irrational in predictable ways, right? We are predictably irrational. So if you know how and why these decisions get made, you can create interventions to improve them at scale.
That's a good one. I'll have to remember that. I remember my first day of econ, they went over the 10 assumptions of economics, and they're like, we assume that human beings behave rationally. And I was like, have you met a person? I was like, we act against our best interest all the time. And it also assumes you know what is someone's quote unquote best interest. There are things like pride and ego that come into play that you just can't really get in a model. And so what does the behavioral economics look like at Wealth? So what do you guys specifically do to influence that change in patients?
Yep. I think it's a very much abstracted down to the highest level. We're trying to motivate a behavior to happen. We're trying to allow that behavior to happen as quickly and simply as possible. And we're trying to reinforce it on a daily basis so that it becomes a habit that sticks. We could talk for hours and hours about all the nitty-gritty details about how we do that exactly. But if you think about any behavior, what we're trying to do is we're trying to give you enough motivation to do the behavior. So we get you over what I call the activation energy required to get that behavior done. We're trying to not add effort or time or frustration to the process. So for example, we want people to take their medications, right? Let's stick with that example we have been using. So we motivate the person to take their medications using financial incentives, right? Because that's a very scalable way to create motivation. We use techniques that are proven in the research base and combine many techniques into one so that we're trying to make that dollar work for itself, right? To the highest degree, right? So an example of that is the way we structure incentives. So we say, hey, here's $30 up front, right? And maybe, hey, Nico, you're a program that's going to be enrolled in our program. Here's $30 a month just to download the app. So that's called the endowment effect. That's a principle that Richard Thaler from University of Chicago, one of the main reasons he got the Nobel Prize in 2017. And it's the same reason that if you've ever flown American Airlines, right, and you're about to land, they say, here's 60,000 miles just to sign up for our credit card today. So by giving you those miles up front, you're like, oh, those are my miles. And then they start to say, well, picture that. That's enough to take you and your loved ones to Hawaiian vacation, right? And so you feel like those are your miles and you really want to keep them. So you sign up for that credit card, right? So we do the same thing. We say, here's your $30. It's already yours. On a daily basis, what we're saying is, hey, it's time to take your medications to avoid the loss of $2. So the reason that we do that is it's called loss framing or leveraging what's called loss aversion. Humans are twice as motivated by a potential loss of money than a potential gain. So we do that and then we let you verify you're taking your medications as quickly and simply as possible. So you put the pills in your hand, you snap the photo. As soon as you snap the photo, there's this immediate reward where you see, you know, this nice animation, it's this great job, you've kept the $2, right? So that piece of the behavior has to be done quickly and simply to get credit. You can't have a process that's tedious or time consuming, right? So if you had to swallow each pill individually and we watched you do it, that would be really frustrating to the users. So we just want the quickest, simple interaction possible, reinforce the behavior as it happens, because you have to have, the incentive has to be salient to the behavior as it happens, right? So a lot of incentive programs that haven't been very successful, there's too much latency between the behavior getting done and the reinforcement and the reward, right? So if you say, hey, do this, and then at the end of the year, I'll give you a $100 check, right? Like, no one's going to actually think about, oh, I'm going to do this and then wait 12 months to get $100, right? So those are some of the principles that we employ to maximize that behavior change and start to reinforce it into a habit. There's a whole nother set of other things that we're trying and testing constantly to further iterate on this, especially on longer time scales, how to keep this habit going over long time frames. And, you know, those are things like integrating in support from your loved ones, right? We call it the sidekick feature. So there's intrinsic motivation coming back to you from your family. Maybe you're getting videos of your grandson saying, great job, grandpa, keep taking those pills, or great job, grandma, keep taking those pills. And, you know, those surprise and delight throughout the course of your program, and you don't know when they're going to come, and, you know, all sorts of stuff. But I think that's a good summary at a high level to help illustrate how, you know, kind of the basics and how we get this behavior to happen.
Yeah, that's kind of like a neuroscience principle of people will rather cure their pain than actually feed their delight if presented with the choice. So it's really awesome that wealth plays on that psychological effect to maximize to adhering to their medication.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great description too. I completely forgot about the surprise and delight moments. So we both did a lot of research on your company, and I thought that was really cool and really cute. So for those at home, it's like, if you adhere to your diabetes medication, you could have like your grandchild or your niece or your nephew like tell you and congratulate you on hitting that milestone, which I think is really amazing, especially when you're going on such a tough journey like that a chronic condition entails. So another thing I wanted to talk about is that we've seen other startups that are using behavioral economics or attempting to try to impact change. So what would you say is like the biggest differentiator between your guys' product and other people?
So I think behavioral economics is a tool, right? The same way that AI is a tool, right? And the same way that, you know, basically you're creating a new business and you're using tools to try to have scalable impact or serve a customer need better than anyone else can, right? But the unique way you deploy those tools and execute is what makes your product or service more valuable than competition, right? So, you know, I think there are many companies that are already trying to use behavioral economics, and I'm sure there will be many, 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 many more as, you know, kind of this research base continues to get more and more popular. And, you know, that definitely is happening, right? There's so many New York Times bestsellers now by, you know, people like Richard Thaler and Dan Ariely. So like, I think the toolkit is going to be increasingly used. But in the same way that, you know, maybe Tesla uses AI to help create self-driving vehicles versus maybe a security company uses AI to catch fraud, right? You're using that tool in drastically different ways. So what we're trying to do is uniquely do the job for our customers of maximizing the improvement of risk. And when we think about risk, I mean morbidity and mortality risk, right? So in any given population, there's a certain level of morbidity, how sick that population is, and how much healthcare expenditures you're going to have to spend on them over, let's call it a 12-month time frame. And in any life insurance use case, you're looking at a pool of individuals and they have mortality risk, and you're going to have to pay out the claim if that individual passes away. So you actually have very aligned interests with your customers. You want them to live as long as possible, right? So what I like about our business is that we have very aligned interests with our members, the patients themselves, the clients, the, you know, insurance companies that we're working on behalf, and society at large, right? So I think what differentiates us? Well, we focus on how can we solve this job better than anyone else possibly could, right? And in today's world, I think a lot of the data-driven businesses, the only competitive moat you have these days is around a proprietary data asset that allows you to do that job better than anyone else can. So in, you know, kind of more traditional businesses, you had competitive moats like Coca-Cola has a brand that no one else can replicate, so they can sell sugar water for twice as much as anyone else can, right? Or if I'm a large-scale manufacturer of cars and I have, you know, the ability to purchase components much cheaper than any upstart company would. And I have the ability to manufacture those cars more efficiently than an upstart would. I have, you know, economies of scale and competitive modes that prevent competition from coming into the market, right? So these are like the classic, you know, more Warren Buffett type of competitive modes. When I think about data businesses, right, what we're trying to do is we're trying to create competitive modes that grow with each new interaction with our user base so that we can do the job better for our customer. And, you know, one quick, simple example, think about Amazon versus Walmart, right? Pretend you were in a time machine, went back to 2002, and Walmart.com launches. And if you were a betting person, you probably would have bet on Walmart destroying Amazon, this small startup at the time that, you know, Walmart had this huge name brand. They had huge distribution networks. They had the ability to purchase inventory, you know, very cheaply. But Amazon won because they gathered a terabyte of data on every Prime user. So they were able to do the job of selling that user what they wanted when they wanted it at the best price possible, better than Walmart ever could, right? So when I think about our business, the moats we're creating, it's all around how do you best serve that member base? How do you best enroll those people? How do you best change their behaviors? How do you best form those habits? And how do you extract as much clinical value out of those habits so that you're maximizing the improvement to that outcome or that risk, right? So we are creating a number of moats at each of those steps because we have, you know, tens of thousands of members that we're reaching out to enroll. So we're able to optimize who do we reach out to when, at what time of day do we reach out to these different cohorts based on, you know, demographic data and psychographic data. When we get a hold of them, what language do we use in order to maximize their enrollment rate? Once they're enrolled, how do we maximize that behavior change on a daily basis? How do we maximize that long-term habit? How do we extract data out of that interaction so that we maximize the clinical value? For example, you know, can we identify five pills in the hand and all of a sudden we see four after, you know, months of taking five and raise the alarm bell, so to speak, on that anomaly to the care team so that they can intervene, right? So that you're trying to maximize this outcome that gets spit out at the end. And so I guess that was a very long-winded way of answering that question. Does that kind of make sense of, you know, kind of what we're trying to do to kind of create these competitive moats against any other startup trying to compete with us?
No, that makes perfect sense. And that's, I think, the perfect level of detail. Honestly, I think if you said anything else, it would have been too high level. Just be like, you know, we try to, you know, we just out-operate, you know, like is the answer you get up from all startups. But that's phenomenal. I love that insight. And I'm sure our listeners will listen to, enjoy that as well. And I saw some stats from your website, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know if this is for typical patients, but you saw 89% of participants are adhering to their care plan, 92% decrease in avoidable ER utilization, and a 45% reduction in readmissions. Is that correct?
Yep. So those are across many different pilots and studies. So that last one of the 45% reduction in readmissions, that's actually a randomly controlled trial that we completed with University of Pennsylvania. So that publication is now out. So that one's really cool because it's, you know, kind of the best academic rigor and study design you could imagine. And then we have these, you know, kind of populations that we're serving on behalf of customers are like real live implementations. And, you know, that data on the 92% reduction to emergency room visits, that was with one of our great clients in Staten Island called Staten Island Performing Provider System. They're one of these at-risk provider networks in Staten Island serving the Medicaid and underserved population. And that was a diabetes population there. So, you know, the first stat was from a heart attack population. The second stat was from a diabetes population. So it's cool to see that this is working in different types of populations.
No, absolutely. And then a quick question before I pass it off to Aman is, how does monetization work for you guys' company?
Yeah, so what we always try to do is we try to make sure our interests are aligned with our customers' interests. So we typically work with them to quantify how much money we could save if we get the non-adherent member on average to become adherent. So we look at these pools of these different disease states. We say, only give us these people who are previously non-adherent to those behaviors. Very quickly, you know, you could look at, for example, sticking with the medication adherence example, the pharmacy data to see who's picking up their pharmaceuticals on time or not. They only give us the non-adherent folks. We quantify how much actuarial value there is in getting that non-adherent member to become adherent. And then we go at risk for the improvement to adherence. So basically, we're guaranteeing ROI without having to do like a shared savings contract where, you know, we're able to just bill a monthly fee based on successful adherence. And they are getting the benefit of, they only give us non-adherent, so they're only paying us when those members enroll and become adherent. And every time they pay us, they're sure they're saving at least four times the amount of dollars that they're paying us.
Mm-hmm. So there's really, I guess, the only downside a customer would have is their time. Other than that, there's no risk to them.
Yep, absolutely.
Phenomenal. That's so exciting. I think that makes a pretty easy business sense for your customers then.
It does, but in healthcare, right, we're working with these very large organizations where, you know, that time expense, that operational expense is quite large up front. So there still are many barriers in kind of getting these programs launched. So I think we had to kind of create this kind of no-brainer sales pitch in order for us to get traction.
In order just to get your foot in the door. And with that, I'll pass it over to Mon to kind of talk a bit more about that topic.
Yeah, for sure. And we talked about getting your foot in the door. We were curious more about like growing your business, because it seems from our research, the largest customers have been payers and providers, you know, insurers or those in the hospital system. And we're wondering kind of the story of getting in front of these large corporate players like insurers or hospitals.
So, I mean, I guess there is an evolution for companies like ours where first you have to kind of prove out what you're doing in very small scale pilots. And then you start to get attention of bigger and bigger customers for bigger, bigger opportunities. So we had to start by leveraging relationships we had through our investors and advisors, and then, you know, kind of getting these early proof points and getting the story out there, right? It's interesting because right now we're still at what I would call the early stages of kind of market growth, right? So we had to prove it first, and then now we're starting to scale it. And so for the first time ever, we're starting to have a cohesive marketing strategy. We're building out a sales team, putting together a whole commercialization strategy. So like, I think, and this might relate to a few of your later questions, in healthcare, right, you have to, the upfront traction stage is very long, right? It takes on average 4 or 5 years to just get that initial traction and proof points, especially if you're touching care and care outcomes, as opposed to more of like an infrastructure or data company that can move a little bit more quickly. And then, you know, once you start to get those outcomes, you can start to market those outcomes and scale up to bigger and bigger clients.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I guess with that, how did you guys kind of build your initial product and were able to kind of prove outcomes? Because I assume that's going to take a significant amount of time to both, one, do the build, put it out in the market, collect the data, figure out if it works, figure out if people are using it correctly. Tell me that kind of that journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think we started with this very science-based approach where we looked at all the research in behavioral economics, saw what was working, what was not working, distilled that down into how do we put this into a technology product that scales those interventions? Because most of those studies are paper and processes with researchers running the study, right? Very, you know, kind of manual effort. So we're trying to create a more scalable intervention. So we, you know, kind of build out an initial most minimally viable product of our app. This is going back to maybe like 2015 or so. We got our first small scale pilots, were very encouraged by the results we saw with the usage of that, but learned a ton, iterated a ton, built a whole new version of the product, got bigger and bigger pilots, saw great results out of those results, still learned a ton. You know, kind of just took the stair step kind of growth function where it's like every few months we would sign a much bigger customer than we had previously, right? And then we would sign a much bigger population. So, you know, I think you have to, without that kind of science-based approach from the start and you know, constantly iterating and learning, you're probably not going to hit, you know, kind of a successful product market fit. But the problem in healthcare is the feedback loop is slow, right? In consumer businesses, you could put an app out, you can A/B test stuff within a week, and then put a new version out and then A/B test it until you find the right product market fit. Whereas in healthcare, right, it takes at least 6 months just to get something going, right? And then it takes like 6 months to run that pilot. And then you have to take those results and learn from them and improve the product. And then that's a whole new development cycle, right? So I think it requires a whole lot of patience and a whole lot of resilience to be a health tech company. It, you know, kind of you're selling to organizations that are very large. They're very, at times, bureaucratic, at times, risk averse. And you're dealing with investors that are typical venture investors, have, you know, want to see progress, want to see growth, want to see, you know, things on a much shorter time frame than healthcare typically allows for. So, you know, those are the dynamics of starting a health tech company. And it's quite a wild ride. And you're there are probably systemic problems with kind of the digital health innovation expectations itself, right? Like, I think the market expects a lot more growth or impact at this point. You know, I think the digital health ecosystem has been in the making for probably about 10 years now. And there are very few unicorns in the space, right? But I think you're starting to see signs that Livongo went public last year and market cap's like $3 billion. Flatiron Health, my very close friend, Michael Laskoff's company, Able2, was just acquired for about $500 million or so. So you're starting to see these successes. They're just longer timeframes than other aspects of, you know, digital innovation.
Yeah, that actually brings me to my next set of questions. And it's like a perfect kind of segue is around the VC piece to this. It is a pretty risk-tolerant business to be in. If you're a VC, the kind of the ROI around a lot of these digital health companies are a long time running. So I'm curious, what is it like to pitch to a VC, first of all, in terms of wealth's business model of paying the actual patient, like we said, the endowment effect, paying the actual patient to adhere, I'm sure is kind of a bit alarming to a VC. And then I have a second question about kind of the types of VC, but that's kind of my first. What is it like to actually pitch to these VCs?
I think you have to understand where VCs are coming from to understand the process, right? They're inundated by, you know, hundreds and hundreds of companies that want their attention and money, right? So I think, you know, you have to be able to get their attention. You have to be able to tell your story. You have to be able to pin a vision of how this company could be a very, very big company in the future, right? And basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to figure out what are the bets they're making. And by that, I mean, how can you de-risk the story for them and say, hey, I've already proven X, Y, and Z for you. So the only thing you have to bet on is, you know, kind of this, right? So at various stages of the business, you're going to have to prove different things, right? So when we raised our seed round, we had to prove, hey, like this concept of behavioral economics works and changes the behavior. Then, you know, we had to prove over time, like, okay, there's a market for this service. There's strong ROI for the customers, and there's a big market that is just starting to grow, and we can win over time, right? And that was more of our Series A, was like, we've proven this out. We've seen the outcomes. We're starting to see the traction in the industry. We're seeing these big insurance companies starting to adopt our services, and there's still a lot more market left to capture, right? That's kind of the Series A. Then at Series B, you know, it's like Series B and beyond, it's like, okay, you've already established this traction. It's accelerating, and we just need more money to continue to execute and grow. And then eventually, right, you know, either if you're going public, it's like, hey, we have captured a lot of market share, and here's why this company is going to be a good steward of your capital for the future and be a, you know, a long-term, very important company in this industry.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess what you had said, like proving that your model works, especially that, I guess you could say, not just in terms of the commitment from management, but how you prove to make an impact over time. I feel like VCs in digital health are much more on board, and perhaps kind of the culture around digital health investing is a little bit different in other industries as well. So that makes a lot of sense. One thing that I found that I'm pretty curious about is the concept of corporate venture capital in the pharma, biotech, digital health arena. It's a lot more prevalent than I've seen in like other spaces, for example, fintech. How is it like receiving investments from CVCs? Do you find it enabling, like, has it been a different process in terms of working with a corporate venture capital arm as opposed to a typical VC?
Absolutely. So all those things we talked about before about, you know, how long the sales cycles are and how long it is to get traction in healthcare specifically is the reason why we've taken a lot of corporate or strategic money. Basically, what we thought was, hey, let's use our equity as a bargaining chip, right? We think our equity is very valuable and is a very good investment. So let's go to the funds that have a vested interest in organizations that could be either customers or partners of ours and raise money from those entities. So they have skin in the game. They want us to be successful and they'll help move a lot of these sales cycles more quickly, right? Hopefully, right? So going back to our first seed round, right? AXA Ventures was our lead, right? And we're now working with their life insurance group. We've created a whole new life insurance product specifically for diabetics that rewards them for just taking care of themselves so that they live a longer, happier, healthier life, right? Boehringer Ingelheim is the co-lead on our most recent round, right? And they are working a lot with us to go out to the market, and they're a great sales channel where, you know, in healthcare specifically, right? What you're looking for is partners or potential customers as your investors, right? And I think the reason that a lot of the fintechs, to your earlier example, aren't funded by, you know, kind of strategics is because a lot of those fintech companies are disrupting, in the classical sense, a legacy business, right? They're trying to make that legacy business obsolete. So if you're Chase, like, you probably should be investing in fintech companies that could disrupt you, but maybe that fintech company doesn't want to take your money because they might be worried you're going to steal their idea or put them out of business or create, you know, moats against them gaining traction. Whereas in healthcare, right, when we think about someone like a Boehringer Ingelheim, you know, they sell great drugs to the market, but those drugs aren't effective if the patients don't take them. So our success is accretive to their success and vice versa, right? That's why I think in healthcare specifically, you have a lot more of this kind of corporate or strategic venture getting involved in these health tech companies because there are aligned interests. And then secondly, I think there's a lot more appetite on the startup side to take that corporate money because, you know, one of those clients moving a little bit more quickly or with a higher certainty could make or break your year, right? Like DaVita, you know, I mentioned earlier how we're working with their teams right now on, you know, three or four different projects, right? Sure, we could have pitched DaVita as a customer, but, you know, they may have been very receptive, but, you know, the fact that we're in their investment portfolio, right, we're able to get the attention a little bit more than some other company coming in and asking them if they wanted to work with that company. So if you think about our business having, you know, typically about 12-month sales cycles, if you can cut just a few months off that sales cycle and you do that with a few different investors, you drastically change the outcomes for our business.
No, that's amazing. I completely agree with you. I think there's just a lot more, like you said, accretive value that comes from working with a big pharma because one kind of appreciates the other. I'm curious, and this will be kind of closer to my wrap-up questions. Have you found it a hindrance to work with other pharmas, competing pharmas, given your association with one CVC?
We haven't seen that. In fact, I think if anything, we've seen the opposite, you know, kind of getting, so to be totally clear, our customer base is mostly still focused on selling to the health systems and the health insurers, right? We're not selling directly to pharma yet. We have some ideas around how we may do that eventually. But what we're doing now with Boehringer Ingelheim is partnering with them to go and sell new value-based programs directly to those health systems and insurers. So they're more of a channel partner than a direct customer. Your point's well taken on if we were looking at Boehringer Ingelheim as a potential customer, right? Would that, if they're both a customer and investor, would that prevent maybe another big pharma from wanting to work with us? There's pros and cons to it, right? Of course, that may be true, but it may also be validation or the validation necessary to get another big pharma to jump in and work with us. So yeah, I think like anything, there's a lot of pros and cons, and especially for certain businesses, you may not want to take strategic capital because of those competitive issues, right? And but you know, in this specific example, we weighed those pros and cons and thought it was definitely way more pros to work with the great team at Boehringer Ingelheim than not.
No, amazing. Yeah, I think it's a fair point. And perhaps that's not the case. Perhaps there is nothing that's hindering over time as kind of there's different ways products are explored. And for some, wealth can be used in some suite of products. For other, potentially pharma companies, if you guys end up working with them, used for another suite of products that are non-competitive. So there's chances for that as well. So yeah, awesome. I guess for me, just to wrap it up a little bit, is where do you kind of see the company going? What is kind of like your 3-year vision, your 5-year vision, or just in general, like your overall optimal place for wealth?
I think we have very ambitious goals here. When we think about what we're trying to achieve is the whole healthcare system, the standard of care is based on a classical economic model, right? We tell patients, go see these doctors, get these tests done. Those doctors, based on the results of those tests, are going to prescribe you behaviors you have to do the rest of your life if you're a chronic patient. And we expect you to do those things, right? So the standard of care doesn't take human psychology into account. We want a world where human psychology, and especially the differences in human psychology, are taken into account in the standard of care itself, right? So we think every patient who has some sort of chronic condition should have a program to help them change the behaviors related to that chronic condition. So that is kind of our big picture strategic goal, is to eventually help the industry rethink the way the standard of care gets created and use behavioral economics and behavior change tools to help patients reach better outcomes. In terms of, you know, kind of more tangibly what we're trying to do, we're trying to be the best possible improvement to morbidity and mortality that we can. We're trying to serve millions of patients. Right now, we're serving about 5,000 patients. We think by this time next year, that will be about 50,000 patients. We think in a 5-year time scale, we can get to several hundred thousand, perhaps even 1 million patients. So our goal is, you know, we've proven out the efficacy and the outcomes of our program. So now we want to make it as big as possible and help as many patients as possible reach those outcomes. So yeah, that's the big picture. But, you know, of course, there's going to be a lot of ups and downs along the way to hopefully end up there.
Amazing. Great to hear. And Matt, just for everybody in the audience, where can listeners continue to follow the great work that you guys are doing at Wealth?
Yeah. So we're doing more and more on kind of helping the market stay up to date with us. So we have a great new director of marketing, Kristen, who is leading a lot of those efforts. You can reach out to us through our website. Our website is wealthapp.com. That's WELLTHAPP.com. We're on various social media outlets, but if you reach out to us and just ask to be added to the mailing list, we can keep you up to date with our quarterly updates. You can subscribe to our website. There's a news section where we post press releases and blog posts. So those are probably the primary ways to keep up to date with us. If you're interested in talking to us about possibly working together, perhaps you are a insurance company or a big provider system, or you're a pharmaceutical manufacturer, we'd be happy to chat in more detail, and you can reach out to us directly through our website.
Great. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to our podcast today. Your attention means the world to us. If you enjoyed today's episode, please feel free to share this episode with a friend. And if you really enjoyed it, if you could go ahead and leave a rating and a review on whatever platform you get your podcast, Iman and I would be over the moon. Stay tuned for our next episode.